This is Daniel Lobel, and you're watching the Paul Leslie Hour. Lucky you.
Hey. Are you here? Are you here? Great. We like you here. Hey, it's time for episode number 1008 of the Paul Leslie Hour. Well, all right. Seven people visiting today, and each one clapped. Thank you very much. Our guest today is comedian Daniel Lobel. Now, Danny knows funny. Now, he's not just humorous, though. He's a deep and thoughtful man. Daniel Lobel co-hosts We Think It's Funny. Check out WeThinkIt'sFunny.com. And you'll see the most recent guest is John Lovitz. We'll be bringing out Daniel Lobel in just seconds. But before we do, did you know that you can be a supporter and a helper of the Paul Leslie Hour? It's easy. Simply visit www.thepaulleslie.com/support and give to yourself and to others the gift of stories. Speaking of stories, Danny? Is Danny here? Oh, he is! He is here! It's time!
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce you all to Daniel Lobel. I have been aware of Danny, or Daniel, for a long time. And I've had it in my mind that he would make a good guest someday, and that day is today. To tell you a little bit about Mr. Lobel, he is a great comedian, a podcast host, a podcast editor, a podcast producer. His latest endeavor is entitled We Think It's Funny, which he co-hosts with Mark Schiff. For the record, I think it's funny. Check it out, folks. It's really good. And just to tell you a few of the guests he's had so far, it would be Darren Carter, Orr Mash, Wayne Fetterman, Mohen, and more to come. So, Daniel Lobel, it's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Great pleasure to be on with you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored.
I'm honored as well. You know, I have to admit, though, I was kind of intimidated to do this interview because when I interviewed Mark Schiff, he kept complimenting again and again. He said, these are great questions. They're phenomenal questions. So I thought, what is my first question going to be for Danny? It's intimidating. So I couldn't decide between, Danny, how has your day been so far, or what is truth?
What a great two questions. What if I was just the opposite of Martin? These are lousy questions. These are, you know, wow, he's the bad cop of the two. The day so far has been great. It's sunny out and no complaints. And what is the truth?
I was kidding. But hey, if you want to take a stab at it.
That's a bit broad question, isn't it? Well, I'm a God believer, so I believe God is the truth. If you want to get more specific than that, it gets a little dicey.
Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't you say that comedians are a lot more serious than most people think they are?
A lot of them are. I think being a comedian, being in comedy, you may be silly getting into it, but it will make you serious over time. It has that effect. And I think part of that, I don't think I'm too serious, but I think part of that is a societal pressure amongst comedians, oddly enough, to be serious, you know, be like, oh, we're serious artists or we're serious people. We're not, you know, clowns or silly or whatever it is. But I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with silly. I like it. I'm a fan. You know, I love guys like Billy Connolly and And George Carlin was often very silly and very serious. And I mean, there's also something about being a comedian that lends itself to a certain insecurity that people feel like they have to prove that they're not just morons because anyone can do it. It's like there's no certification or something. It's not like you went to college for it, although now you can. But certainly it's not like becoming a doctor. So people have an insecurity about that, and they want to show that they're smart and that they're, you know, have a refined character or something to that effect. So they overcompensate with seriousness to make up for the fact that what they do is ridiculous. And I mean, it's supposed to be ridiculous. I mean, it's not to say that it doesn't have great value to it, but it's inherently ridiculous to choose a career where you stand up and just say thoughts you had. That's and try and package those thoughts in a way that evokes laughter. It's a silly thing. And it's child's play, really. You know, I've got little kids, and little kids love to put on a show. It's a child thing to do, to put on a show. And little kids are naturally funny. They don't have to try to be funny. They don't have to think of witty things to say. They don't have to try and figure out how to package their thoughts. They're just funny because they're funny. So to get up and do a show and be funny is a child's thing to do. And, you know, some of us are probably stunted in some way and try and make money at it. And then to validate that and try and act like they're very, you know, these extreme intellectuals and, you know, they're very serious about their comedy. But I have thoughts on it, obviously. So,
well, I'll tell you this, Daniel. You've answered that question in a way that nobody else I've heard has said. So comedy, in a way, is to kind of return to your childhood in some roots. That's interesting.
Well, you know, it's harnessing the inner child for, you know, and I think it's also what destroys a lot of comedians, because the inner child is very dangerous. It's very dangerous to, as it performs in the adult world. You know, I used to open for Ralphie May of blessed memory. He was a lovely guy and a very funny guy. And I think what really did him in is that he couldn't harness that inner child. What makes a comedian very funny is they've given that kind of id or whatever it is that the mischief within them permission to come to the surface. And if you try to function as an adult, but as, you know, using the skills of a child, you usually burn out pretty fast. And I think, you know, you see that with a lot of comedians that don't live very long. That's because they're rebelling against all the things that seemed like rules and serious to them as a kid. And they said, well, when I become older, I'm going to be a kid and get to be the kid I never got to be when I was a kid. Sometimes that's the case, not always. But, you know, that's, they're like, you know, and all those rules and all those adults that tried to, you know, make me get in line, well, they won't have any power over me then. And I'll just, you know, and then, you know, it's not always so good. So I think the trick to it is to be able to tap into that inner child, to get the funny, and to use that to entertain people and bring them joy in the same way that a child brings a joy to adults, and then be able to learn to turn that off so that you can survive in an adult world.
Good stuff.
I think I'm very aware that this hasn't been funny at all, and that it's been very clinical. But you know, in terms of the way I think about these things, but I think about them. So you asked.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's, I think, going into another point. One of the reasons I like your podcast, we think it's funny so much, is because it's funny, but also a lot of the questions you all are tackling, you know, if you saw them written out, like, wow, these are serious questions. I mean, in some respects, the world's on fire, in, you know, all the time. But yeah. There was something that I wish you guys had gone into just a little bit more, and I wished I'd heard you go into this. It was something that was on We Think It's Funny. Danny, is comedy something you either have or you don't?
See, I think they were saying yes. You're talking about the Wayne Fetterman episode with Mark Schiff.
Right.
I half agree with that. I mean, I think there's a natural innate funniness to some people, and some people there isn't. I do think there's a little middle ground, though, where some people are kind of funny and they don't give themselves permission to be. And so I guess that answer is still their answer, that they are funny, but it's like being repressed. So they are funny, but they're not allowing themselves to be funny. And in those situations, I think you can sort of take someone who presents as not funny and teach them how to be funny, because they are innately funny. They're just, for whatever reason, insecure to be funny or afraid or whatever. But I do think, yes, I do think you do have to understand. I think if you understand humor really well, then you should be able to be funny. If you're somebody who doesn't really get comedy or doesn't really laugh much because you don't think things are funny that other people find funny, or you don't find anything funny, I think you might be a lost cause for comedy. But I think if you're somebody who intellectually understands why things are funny and can construct funny thoughts, but you aren't a naturally funny person, you could train yourself to deliver your funny thoughts in a funny way. Does that kind of answer that?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Aside from just the fact that you like it, why do you do it?
I usually like it. I usually love it. Sometimes I like it, and sometimes I don't like it. And those times, those days, you know, I just do it because I really do like the idea of lifting people's spirits, you know, that you can take a bunch of people who are dealing with all the crap in their life every single day, and bills and whatever, it's involved in raising their kids or their marriage or their car problems, whatever it is, health problems. And they can get into a room and just forget about it all for a while and laugh and feel good. And that's a great gift to be able to give people. And I mean, even on days that I'm not enjoying doing it, I try to remind myself of that. By the way, usually whenever I get up on stage and I get that first laugh, I'm enjoying it again. But some days I'm like, why did I agree to do this show? And why did I leave the house? It was so cozy in the house. And it's so there's no potential for things to not go right as much as if you stay home, you know. Of course, the reverse of that's also true. Like if you leave the house, things could go really right. And, you know, if you have a good set and, you know, it could lead to opportunities. But also, you know, if things don't go the way you want them to go, you could wind up ruining your night, which would have been a perfectly fine night if you hadn't left the house. So sometimes I wonder, like, why did I gamble with my night? You know, this could have been 100% a great night, and now it's questionable.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Are you in competition with other comedians?
No. I'm barely even aware of what's going on out there these days. I just kind of focus on my own, what I'm doing. I at one point I realized that there's only one me, you know? So I've had material stolen from me, which sucks. Even by pretty high profile people, it's happened over the years. And that can make you feel like, you know, you're in competition or something like that, or like you better get famous fast so nobody can take it and claim it's yours. That kind of thing has happened, you know, where like you think if only I was like famous, then they would be afraid to do this to me, you know? But in terms of what I realized is the jokes are jokes and that's nice, but really what makes a comedian great is that you like their personality, you like them. Nobody can be that but you. So, you know, I usually, when I watch a comic, unless they're like an amazing joke writer like Al Lubell, I don't really remember too many of the jokes. I just remember enjoying or not enjoying their essence of who they are, you know? So I don't see how that's, you know, and if I am in competition, I've already failed a long time ago. So I don't have to worry, because, you know, I did cross country for a little while, because when I was in high school, there was a girl on the cross country team who I had a big crush on, and I wanted to have the opportunity to try and hit on her on the bus on the way to meets and stuff, which didn't ever turn into anything. But I did wind up doing these cross country runs, and I was overweight then too, not as much, but I was never in good shape. And everybody would finish like an hour before me. And sometimes I feel like that in life, like, but I would eventually finish the race. You know, I would eventually finish the run. It's just like, I was nowhere near, you know, in the realm of competition. Like, you know, there's no like 23rd place, you know, you just sort of like, I just kind of like, at a certain point, it was so frustrating, because I realized even when I pushed myself really, really hard, I was still nowhere near the last person besides me to get to the end of the run. And I just came to terms with the fact that, well, I'm just going to enjoy the run for the run, you know, I'm just going to enjoy it and stop, because I was just beating myself up too hard about the fact that I was so behind everyone. And that's how I've come to it in comedy to some extent as well, where it's just like, I enjoy the run for the run. You know, if I look at it in terms of like career achievements and stuff like that, I'm just like an hour behind everybody else that I started with, at least. So I just enjoy the run for the run.
I like that. I've found that it tends to be the most miserable people are constantly comparing themselves in every single way that you can. Mm-hmm. My observation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And the times when I was younger, when I would do that, it does make you sad. So, you know, and then I've always been like, well, my objective is never to be sad. So anytime I catch myself doing things that make me sad, I try and eliminate those behaviors or thought patterns, because it's detrimental to where I want to be. I don't want to be sad. Everybody, if you ask everybody, what do they want to be? They want to be happy. And then you say, well, why aren't you happy? And then they tell you, so, well, then just stop thinking like that. You know? So whenever I catch something like that, where I'm like, oh, that makes me sad to think like that or whatever, then I just say, oh, well, you know, it's funny. Like when I did a Marc Maron's podcast one time, and he was asking me if I was becoming religious at the time. And we talked about and how people say, well, it's, you know, it's not real. It's not reality. These people that don't believe in religion have this cynicism about it. And I said, people just do it because it makes them feel good. And I said, well, I'm okay with that too, you know, because, you know, I came to that thought in that interview, but I stand by it still. I think, you know, even if I'm wrong about all of this religious stuff, if it makes me feel good, that is the objective that most of us are trying to reach. So like, nobody's ever gone into a comfortable chair and said, yeah, this chair is comfortable, but I'd rather sit in the uncomfortable one because it's real, man. You know, it's like, you know, if life is meaningless, then you should at least be happy throughout it. You know, that's, I don't understand. Sometimes you see like atheists who are so depressed. I would think that they should adopt whatever philosophy, whether they believe it or not, because if life is meaningless, then what's the point of real anyway? You should just be happy. I don't know. So either way, I feel it lends itself to unless being God observant doesn't make you happy. But if it does, then I think whether you're right or wrong, it's a good decision.
Very good. Well, tell us a little bit about your co-host on We Think It's Funny, Mark Schiff. What makes him a good co-host and a good friend?
Mark Schiff is calling as you asked that. That's funny.
Put him on.
He must have heard it. His ears were ringing. Mark is terrific. I'm just it's cool because I'm a big fan of his, you know, and I try to not be a fan on the show to the best of my ability because I don't want to be like, you know, it's Mark and a fan doing a show. I try to pretend like, you know, we're both just the comedians on whatever the same level is. But, you know, when the mics go off, I know he's Mark Schiff, and I'm aware that I'm working with like one of the great comedians, you know. He may be one of the great unsung heroes of comedy because, I mean, he's terrifically funny, leaps and bounds above most comedians you'll ever see or meet. And he's also funny in an understated way because, he can just slip in the little comments and stuff that are just brilliantly funny in a conversation. And he does it as if they're not funny. He knows they're funny, but he kind of just throws them in there, and he doesn't deliver them. You know, I'm not talking about on stage. I'm talking about in conversation. He'll just slip in things that are punchlines as if they're you know throwaways. And I think the world of Mark. And on top of that, he's also one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. He's insightful. He's witty, and he's kind. So I mean, you know, obviously I don't like him.
But you all do have a good bit in common.
There's the religious element that we both found our way to observant Judaism, and that we both weren't, and we both, you know, were maniacs when we were younger in comedy and probably burned a lot of the bridges and just were wild men in our own way. I didn't know him back then, but from his stories, and he didn't know me back then. Probably had we known each other, we would have imploded or something, but the friendship would have imploded. But I think because we both met each other at a point in life where we had normalized, you know, or at least calmed down a little bit, whatever, you know, we can jive pretty well, you know?
Well, the podcast that you all host is just kind of getting off the ground now. And I'm curious, do you have any dream guests? And I know that from your other shows, you've had the chance to talk to some really interesting, really funny, really iconic people, like how I got exposed to you, the late, great Joe Franklin. I listened to that interview. It just touched me so much. I knew him just a little, but tell us about your dream guests.
I mean, my dream guests are always, you know, I've never had these people on that I've always wanted to have on. And some of them are dead now, you know, like Don Rickles, I always really wanted to interview. And that one seems like it's off the table unless we can get some good AI going. But Jim Carrey, I would love to have on. Eddie Murphy, Adam Sandler, And Woody Allen, of course, I'd love to have Woody Allen, if you've been listening to, you may know that I know him a bit, but I've never been able to get him to agree to an interview. And I've been at least friendly with him for like, I don't know, like 16 years or so. But that still hasn't, and I'm friends with his friends, but it still hasn't been able to get me to cinch the deal on an interview with him. I just think we'd have a great interview, and we've already got a lot we've talked about that would be fun to talk about in an interview, and I think it would be fun, but I haven't been able to get him to do that, and I may never be able to, but we're talking dreams, so I would love him to do it. So if he's listening,
if he's listening or reading the transcript, Mr. Woody Allen, You got to go on. We think it's funny. That would be fantastic.
You'd be great with me and Mark, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
So. In a lot of ways, both of you have a Woody Allen-esque element to some of your comedy, which I mean is the biggest compliment. I'm a huge Woody Allen fan.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure he was a big influence on Mark, and he was certainly a big influence on me. I mean, you know, he's pretty much the gold standard, I think, for joke writing. I can't think of a better joke writer. I mean, I think perhaps the best joke deliverer is Billy Connolly, who I have had on my old show. So he was a dream guest. Of course, I'd love to have him back, but I don't know if that's something he can do right now because of his health. But he's definitely maybe the best ever at delivering a joke. And then in terms of delivery, I also loved Mort Saul. In terms of like an out of this world kind of delivery, Robin Williams. These were all great joke deliverers. But in terms of just a strictly great joke writer, I mean, I can't think of anybody better than Woody. Then after Woody, I could tell you people like Stephen Wright, and, you know, people like George Carlin or Jackie Mason, all brilliant. And Jackie was probably the best combo of writer and performer. He wasn't the best performer. He wasn't the best writer, but he was probably the best writer performer that I could think of.
He was right there in the Venn diagram.
Right, yeah.
On both of those things. Something that I have to say I kind of felt a kinship with you is that we are both married to someone who's a publicist. And it wasn't long ago, we were on the porch and I was asking her for advice. Like, you know, hey, what can I do to keep the podcast, you know, maybe get some exposure. And I'm dead serious about this. She gave me all this advice. The next morning, I checked my email. There was an invoice. She invoiced me. But it's got to be helpful for you. You know, you're able to get the expertise and the knowledge of a publicist with what you do.
Yeah, you know, I've similar to what you were saying, I've joked that I wish I could afford her because she's busy, you know, working for people who have money. And, you know, if I could get her to put her attention to what I'm doing, it would be pretty helpful. But she doesn't have the time to both make an income and work for free on my stuff. So, you know, knowledge is good. If I could get, you know, she's amazing. So, like, I often wish I was one of her clients, but, you know, I'll settle for husband.
So we're even more in the same boat then. Very interesting.
Yeah.
There was something that you were saying on stage. I saw this clip, and if I had been able to go down and see you, you're not that far, but it's a pretty good distance from where I am to Florida, where you were. You cracked me up with the bit about you know, I wish I was big enough to be canceled. with the whole Palestinian thing.
Right.
Do you think that at a certain level, canceling has helped certain comedians?
Oh, yeah. Certainly, yeah. You know, it's like the no publicity is bad publicity thing. I mean, it certainly evokes sympathy from people who wouldn't otherwise care about you. You know, I used to find that when I would do my podcast and I was going through depression years ago, when I would talk about the depression stuff, I would get so many emails and people would really connect to it. And if I would talk about things going well, not much. And then when I wasn't depressed anymore and I figured my way out of depression, which was a long, arduous process that I'm glad I did. And I've been able to stay from, I think of depression as like a pit, you know, I've been able to keep myself from falling back in the pit for years. But I felt like a lot of people felt like I abandoned them, listeners that used to correspond to me about depression. And then I was like, well, I'm not I'm not depressed anymore. And they'd be like, well, surely you're lying to yourself. And I'm like, well, I'm not. You know, I found, like I was telling you, one at a time, I knocked out things that made me upset, and I just eliminate them. And then I found myself, I wasn't left with anything to be too upset about, or like, and I started finding good coping mechanisms to handle things better, and communication got better, and all these things. Anyway, I lost a community, a depressed community. And I realized, you know, hurting people, because they're so raw and they're hurt, they bond so much better than not hurting people. So if you get canceled, you seem like a wounded person, and all the people who feel wounded in their own lives and who feel canceled in their own marriages or at work or whatever it is, all of a sudden feel this kinship with you, and they want to be part of your comeback or whatever it is. And you know, but when you're sort of like, you know, like me, like, yeah, I do okay. I'm not canceled and I'm not famous. It's not as easy to find a community for that. But I don't know, if I let it get to me, maybe I'll get depressed and I'll have a bigger audience again. But, I don't let it get to me too much, but I do think it helps people to get canceled. I do think people love the underdog, and everybody kind of sees themselves as an underdog, except very confident people, and then they're fine. But I think the answer is yes, it helps people.
I had all these labels that I put on you at the beginning, that you're a comedian, a comic book writer, a podcast producer. Who would you say Daniel Lobel is at heart?
In terms of career, or
any way you want to approach it?
I guess really I like storytelling, you know, whether it's on the radio or on a podcast or in a comic book or on stage or in a film. I like crafting a story together in a good way to present your ideas to someone, and I try and make the stories fun or funny, and I love stories since I was a little kid. I love when my dad would read me stories, and I think that's what drives a lot of the world is stories. Like when you drive down the road and you see all these billboards for movies or whatever in LA, it's all just people trying to sell you on a good bedtime story. You know, it's like, it also goes back to just like being a kid, you know, these warm moments that you have when you hear a great story for the first time. And that's what everybody's trying to do is deliver that. And then the ridiculousness of Hollywood and everything is that they give out best story awards and stuff like, best at telling the story, best at acting out the parts of the story, best at making music for the story. You know, it's all story time, you know? So if I had one real skill, I'd say it's storytelling. And then I just apply it to different art forms, whether it's storytelling through images or storytelling through words or storytelling through performance or moving pictures, whatever it is. I just try to tell the story using whatever mediums are available.
I always like to, at the end of the show, the last minute or two, I just let the guest go anywhere that they want to go. They can say whatever they want. What's that?
I was just being silly. I said, can we go to Hawaii? We can go anywhere we can go. And you go, all right. And then I show them, look at my email inbox, and there's tickets. If that's the offer, hey, I let the guests go anywhere they want to go.
What would you say?
What were you really suggesting when I interrupted? Well,
I mean, it's really, you can go anywhere. I've applied when I can remember to do it. The little bit of truism or advice that Mark Schiff gave I remember it from time to time, and it's really helped me when I remember to apply it. But you could say anything.
Anything, huh? Oh. Always approach people with a smile when you can. You know, it's hard to be conscious of that, but it's something I learned from my rabbi growing up. May he rest in peace. Rabbi Asher Avitan of blessed memory. He was from Morocco, from Casablanca. He was a short guy, and he always had a big smile. And anytime I'd ever see him, I was immediately happier, because you'd just be approached with this big, happy, warm smile. So if you can, always try to smile to people, because it's the easiest way to sort of like make the world a little better. You know, you may not always agree with people politically or theologically or whatever it is, but most people are happy for a smile, and despite all of that, you know. So as divided as the world may be, you know, unless you're talking about like terrorist extremists or something, I don't know how they would take a smile. Probably there's a level of sociopath that doesn't like a smile, but I think the vast majority of people are uplifted by a smile.
Absolutely. Well, everybody out there, it's DannyLobell.com, LOBELL. And also, I can't wait to get this, the comic book, kind of a Harvey Picar kind of influence. It's called Fair Enough. Everybody should check out Fair Enough by Danny Lobell. And Danny, or Daniel, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, me too. Terrible questions, but I loved the show. I know, it was great questions. FairEnoughComic.com is where they can get the comic books if they want. And I'll sign them, and I'll mail them myself. The mailing is the hardest part of the whole thing, because you have to go to the post office and stand in a line. But I do it. I don't have anyone who does it for me.
Just for them.
I should just probably ramble on about this, and then you just, you know, slowly fade out the audio. You know, thank you for everything. Thanks for taking the time to do this, and for putting the effort into making it really a great interview. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. If I can ever be of service, just let me know.
You know how to do tile work? No. All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right. You have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
You know, the Paul Leslie Hour is made possible by people like you, listeners, viewers. Please go to thepaulleslie.com/support, and you'll know what to do when you're there. Thank you. Thank you, everyone who contributes. Performance of The Entertainer intro song by John Primerano. And of course, this is your announcer speaking. See you next time on the Paul Leslie Hour.